Hello, great to see you all. Thank you for all being here today. So I know I coined this term in shitification about platform decay, and you've come expecting me to talk about decaying tech platforms. But actually this morning I want to start by talking about nursing. So there was a January 2025 report from the Groundwork Collective that documented how increasingly American nurses are now hired from one of three apps that bid themselves out as Uber for nursing. And the way that these apps work is that a nurse never knows from shift to shift how much they're going to get paid for hours, for the hours they work. And there is a high-tech thing going on behind the scenes with those nurses' wages. Those nursing apps, it's a cartel of just three companies, ShiftKey, ShiftMed, and CareRev, they can play all kinds of games with the way that labor is priced. Before ShiftKey offers a nurse a shift, they go to a data broker and they buy that nurse's current financial situation. And if the nurse is carrying a lot of credit card debt, especially delinquent credit card debt, then they lower the wage that's offered to that nurse for that shift. Because the more desperate you are, the less you'll accept to come into work and do that grunt work of caring for the sick, the elderly, and the dying. Now, obviously, there are a lot of things going on in this example, and every one of them is terrible, but the reason I bring it up is that it's emblematic of enshittification, this word that I coined to describe the decay of online platforms. When I first started writing about enshittification, most of my work focused on the external symptoms of enshittification, a three-stage process I described, which we can exemplify with Google, which at first minimized ads and maximized spending on engineering to produce really good search results. But as they were doing that, they were buying their way to dominance. They bribed every service, every product that had a search box to make sure that that was a Google search box, so that no matter what browser you were using, what OS you were on, no matter which carrier you were using, you were always searching Google by default. And this became so extreme that by the early 2020s, Google was spending enough money to buy an entire Twitter, like every 18 months, just to make sure that you and everyone you knew never tried a search engine that wasn't Google. And so that is the first stage of enshittification, when a platform is good to its end users, but finding a way to lock in those end users. Stage two comes when the platform understands that those users are locked in will have a hard time departing, and it starts to make things worse for them in order to enrich business customers. So for in Google's case, that's publishers and advertisers. And now we see in stage two an ever larger fraction of a Google search results page is given over to ads, and they are marked off with ever subtler, ever smaller, ever grayer labels distinguishing them from the organic search results. And Google, of course, uses commercial surveillance data to target ads to us. So that's stage two. Things are getting worse for end users, but better for business customers. But those business customers, they're also getting locked into the platform. You know, one of the things that's underappreciated about competition law and competition theory is that while we focus a lot on monopolies, where you have a powerful seller, we ignore the impact of monopsonies, powerful buyers. If you're a firm that's getting 20% of your business from one buyer, that almost might as well be 100% of your business, because very few firms can afford a 20% overnight drop. And so firms get enormous power. And so as Google gains this power over its publishers, over its advertisers, you get to stage three of enshittification, which is clawing back all the value in the platform until all that's left is a kind of homeopathic residue, right? Just the least value needed to keep both business customers and end users locked to the platform. And that's when Google becomes enshittified. Now, we know about one example of this from the Google antitrust case. Google has lost three monopoly cases in the last 18 months. It's been adjudicated a monopolist thrice over. And in one of these cases, we found out about what happened in 2019. In 2019, Google hit a turning point. They controlled 90% of the search market, and everyone who searched on Google searched everything on Google, right? If you had some stray thought come into your head, you would rush to a Google search box and you would type those words into Google. And that meant that Google's search growth was plateauing, right? Because there was no way for them to grow their search. Well, how is Google going to grow? There were no more users. They could, you know, raise a billion humans to adulthood and make them Google customers, which is Google Classroom. But, you know, that's a slow process. They needed some other way to juice that growth. And the internal memos that came to light in the DOJ case against Google tells us what happened. They made search worse. They reduced the system's accuracy so that you had to search twice or more to get the answers that you used to get with a single search, and that would double or triple the number of queries, which double or tripled the number of ads. And so this was obviously bad news for us as searchers, but it was also at the same time they were attacking their business customers. So for example, Google entered into an illegal collusive arrangement with Meta called Jedi Blue, where they gamed the advertising sales market so that publishers got paid less and advertisers had to pay more. They rigged those markets. And this is how we get to the enshittified Google of today, where you search on Google, and at the top of the search results page is just a mountain of AI slop. And then there's five paid results underneath it marked with the word ad in 8.90% gray on white type. And then over that is 10 spammy SEO links from someone else who's figured out how to game Google. And so this is what Google looks like today. And the amazing thing about this is that we are still using Google because we're locked into it. So that's enshittification. That's what it looks like from the outside. You have a platform that's good to its end users, finds a way to lock them in, makes things worse for end users, brings in business customers, locks them in because they're dependent on those users, then makes things worse for users, takes all the value for themselves, and the platform turns into a pile of shit. Right? That is enshittification. It's a tragedy in three acts. So like I said, when I started talking about this, I was mostly focused on this outward enshittification, like what you could observe as enshittification took hold. But it's important to talk about what's going on inside these firms, the thing that makes enshittification possible, the technical mechanism of enshittification. I call that mechanism twiddling. Because digital businesses, they have this infinite flexibility. After all, they are built on top of infinitely flexible Turing-complete universal von Neumann machines, the modern computer, which can run every valid program. And that gives platforms an infinity of knobs that they can turn to change the business logic so that every time you visit a platform, every time you interact with a platform, the prices, the costs, the search rankings, the recommendations might all be different. Because every app makes a call to the cloud to ask how it should perform in that moment. And this brings us back to those nurses. The scam where a nurse's debt load is first looked up before they're offered a wage, and then that wage is titrated down based on their debt in real time, that's just twiddling. It's something you can only do with computers. The bosses who are doing this, they're not more evil than the bosses we had before. They just have better tools. These aren't even tech bosses. They're just bosses with some tech. So digitalization, when you weave computers into a firm or into a sector, enables the twiddling that allows firms to shift value around from end users to business customers back to end users, back to themselves, to their shareholders and their executives. And this means that platforms that or that sectors that digitize are liable to enshittification. And every sector is moving to a digital backend, like nursing, and every platform is enshittifying, just like nursing. The legal scholar Vina Dubel, she coined a term to describe the twiddling that suppresses the wages of debt-burdened nurses. It's called algorithmic wage discrimination. And it follows the gig economy. The gig economy is a major locus of enshittification. It's kind of a tear in the membrane that separates the virtual world from the physical world. And gig work is that place where your shitty boss is a shitty app and you're not allowed to call yourself an employee. So Uber invented this trick. If you're an Uber driver and you're picky about which job you're willing to take, Uber starts to offer you a higher and higher wage until you start accepting rides. But if you yield to temptation and start accepting those rides, then the wage starts to push down and down at random intervals in increments that are too small for human beings to readily notice. So this is not so much like boiling the frog as slowly poaching it. And what happens is that Uber drivers find that they are inevitably being moved into a situation where they've incurred some significant capital costs, like buying a new car. They've given up the side hustles they used to have that let them be more selective about which rides they're willing to take, but now they're stuck in a below starvation wage. So twiddling is just a crude trick that's done very quickly. And of course, as we know, as coders and hackers and technical people, any task that is simple but time consuming is a prime candidate for automation. This kind of wage theft would be unbelievably tedious, labor-intensive, and expensive if you had to perform it manually. No 19th century warehouse full of guys in green eye shades could pull this trick off. You need digitization to make this happen. So twiddling nurses' hourly wages, it's a perfect example of the role that computers play in enshittification. Because this kind of thing, it's not just bad for nurses, for the suppliers, it's also bad for the users, the patients. I mean, do you really think that paying nurses based on how desperate they are at a rate calculated to increase their desperation so that they'll accept ever lower wages is going to result in us getting the best care when we see a nurse? Do you really want your catheter inserted by a nurse on food stamps who drove an Uber until midnight the night before and skipped breakfast this morning so that they could pay the rent? This is why it's so misguided to say if you're not paying for the product, you're the product. If you're not paying for the product, ascribes a kind of mystical power to advertising-driven services, the power to bypass our critical faculties by spying on us and data mining the resulting dossiers to locate our mental blind spots and weaponize them to get them to buy anything that an advertiser wants to pay to sell us. In this formulation, we are complicit in our own exploitation because we choose to buy free services that invites us to be abused by surveillance capitalists who've perfected a mind control ray powered by surveillance data that we are voluntarily handing over surveillance data to improve. And the moral of the story is supposedly that if we only went back to paying for things instead of unrealistically demanding that things be free, we could restore capitalism to its functional non-surveillance state, and companies would treat us better because we'd be customers and not products. That's why the surveillance capitalism hypothesis elevates companies like Apple to virtuous alternatives, because Apple is charging us money and not attention, and that means it can focus on giving us better service and not exploiting us. Now, there is a plausible superficial logic to this. After all, in 2022, Apple famously updated iOS, and they introduced a tick box that lets you opt out of third-party surveillance. Most notably, it lets you opt out of Facebook surveillance. 96% of all Apple users ticked that box. The other 4% were either drunk or Facebook employees or drunk Facebook employees, which makes sense because if I worked at Facebook, I'd have to be drunk all the time. So on the face of it, it seems like Apple is not going to treat its customers like products. But simultaneously, as they rolled out this privacy measure in iOS, they secretly turned on a second surveillance system on iPhones that gathered exactly the same data from iOS users to power their own surveillance advertising network. They gave those users no notice. They gave them no way to opt out. And when journalists discovered what they'd done and published it, they lied about it. It goes without saying that $1,000 Apple distraction rectangle in your pocket is something that you paid for. The fact that you paid for it doesn't stop Apple from treating you like the product. Apple treats you like the product. It treats its business customers, the app vendors, like the product, screws them out of 30 cents for every dollar they bring in with mandatory payment processing fees that are 3,000% the going rate for payment processing. So Apple treats end users, the people who shell out a grand for a phone, like the product. It spies on them to target ads to them. It treats everyone like the product. That's what's going on with gig app nurses. The nurses are the product. The patients are the product. The hospitals are the product. In enshittification, the product is anyone you can productize. Fair and dignified treatment is not something you get as a customer loyalty perk in exchange for parting with your money rather than your attention. The nurses are the product. They are being twiddled because they've been conscripted into the tech industry by digitization of their industry. So it's tempting to blame tech for this. But tech companies were not born enshittified. They spent decades making pleasing products. If you're old enough to remember when Google launched, you'll recall that at the outset, Google was magic. You could ask Jeeves questions for 1,000 years and still not get an answer as crisp, as useful, as helpful as the answer you would get by typing just a few vague keywords into a Google search bar. That's the reason we all switched to Google, and why we all bought iPhones, why we joined our friends on Facebook. And all of those services were born digital. And they could have enshittified at any time. But they didn't until they did, and then they did it all at once. So social factors are much more important than the mere technical specifications of a technology. Social factors are the difference between a system that warns you if your car is drifting out of the lane and a system that narcs you out to your insurer so they can raise your bill that month by $10 because you drifted out of the lane. I believe that insurification is not caused by changes to technology, but to the policy environment. Changes to the rules of the game undertaken in living memory by named parties who were warned at the time of the likely outcome of their actions, who did it anyway, who are today very rich and respected, and face no consequences, no accountability for their role in ushering in the inshitocene, who venture out into polite society without ever once wondering whether anyone is sizing them up for a pitchfork. In other words, I think we created a crimogenic environment, a perfect breeding pool for the most pathogenic practices in our society, who therefore multiplied, dominating decision-making from our firms and our states, leading to a vast enshittening of everything. And while that's very dismal, there's some good news hidden in that. Because if enshittification is not down to a new kind of evil person or the great forces of history bearing down on this moment to turn everything to shit, but rather the result of specific policy choices, then we can reverse those policy choices. We can make better policy choices. We can emerge from the enshittocene, consign the enshitter net to the scrap heap of history, a mere transitional state from the old good internet that we used to have and the new good internet that we could have. So let's talk about the kind of corporation that you get when you create a crimogenic environment, an enshittogenic environment. Now, every company wants to maximize profits. And to maximize profits, it's a simple formula. Charge as much as you can, pay workers and suppliers as little as you can, and spend as little as possible on quality and safety. Every dollar you don't spend on suppliers, quality, or safety, or customers is a dollar that can go to executives and shareholders. There is a simple model of a corporation that could maximize its profits just by charging infinity dollars, paying nothing to workers or suppliers, and spending nothing on making the product any good. But we understand that corporation doesn't make any money for the obvious reason that no one wants to buy what it's selling and no one wants to work for it. So external constraints act as disciplining forces, tamping down the impulse to charge infinity and deliver nothing. Now, in technology, we are blessed with four constraints that make companies better. These are anti-enshittificatory sources of discipline that cause firms to pay their workers more, improve product quality, and keep executives and shareholders' wealth from growing at the expense of customers, suppliers, and labor. Now, the first of these constraints is the one that we're very familiar with. It's just markets. All other things being equal, businesses that charge more and deliver less lose customers to firms that are more generous about sharing value with customers, workers, and suppliers. This is the bedrock of capitalist theory. It is the bedrock of antitrust law. In 1890, Senator John Sherman, brother of Tecumseh Sherman, author of the Sherman Act, the first antitrust law, took to the floor of the Senate and said, "If we will not endure a king over as a political power, we should not endure a king over the production, transportation, or sale of the necessaries of life. If we would not submit to an emperor, we should not submit to an autocrat of trade with the power to prevent competition and fix the price of any commodity." Let's hear it for Senator Sherman. He's been dead a while, but somewhere he's smiling. So Senator Sherman, he was reflecting this popular outrage of the day, this anti-monopolist movement that had bubbled up from the grassroots because people were angry about proprietors of monopolistic firms assuming the role of dictators with the power to decide who would work, who would starve, what could be sold, and what we would pay for it. Lacking competitors, these people became too big to fail, they became too big to jail, and that made them too big to care. So what happened to the disciplining force of competition on our firms? Well, we killed it. Some 40 years ago, the Reaganomic views of Chicago school economists transformed antitrust. They threw out John Sherman's idea that we needed to keep companies competitive to prevent the emergence of autocrats of trade, and they installed a new idea that monopolies are presumptively efficient, and they did it all over the world, in the US, the UK, the EU, and Asia. And the idea was that if Google has a 90% market share, which it does, then you should infer from that that Google is the best search engine ever made. And the only reason a new, better search engine hasn't emerged is because Google is so skilled, they're so efficient, that there's no conceivable way to improve on it. In other words, we can tell that Google is the best at search because they have a monopoly, and we can tell that that monopoly is a good one because they are the best at search. So 40 years ago, the U.S. and its major trading partners adopted a pro-monopoly policy, and we got monopolies. We got monopolies in pharma, in beer, in glass bottles, vitamin C, athletic shoes, microchips, cars, mattresses, eyeglasses, and of course, professional wrestling. Now, the economists who conceived of these policies, they're still with us. They're out there polishing their fake Nobel Prizes, teaching at elite schools, making millions of dollars consulting for blue chip firms. And when we confront them with the wreckage their policies created, they protest their innocence. They maintain with a straight face that there is no way to affirmatively connect pro-monopoly policies with the rise of monopolies. It's like we used to put down rat poison, and we didn't have a rat problem, and then these guys made us stop, and now rats are chewing our faces off, and they're out there making wide, innocent eyes saying, how can you be sure that our anti-rat poison policies resulted in the global rat conquest? Maybe we are simply living through the time of the rat. Maybe sunspots caused rats to become more fecund than at any time in history. And sure, the rats did buy all the rat poison factories and shut them down, but what of it? After all, if you're not going to put down rat poison, then shutting down the rat poison factory is economically rational. It is a Pareto optimal decision. So markets don't discipline tech firms because tech firms don't compete with their rivals. They buy them. That's a quote. It's a quote from Mark Zuckerberg, a man who puts all of his dumbest ideas in writing. A memo he sent out that said, it is better to buy than to compete. Which is why Mark Zuckerberg bought Insta for $1 billion at a time when it had 12 employees and only 25 million users. As he wrote in a spectacularly ill-advised, middle-of-the-night, fully admissible in court email to his CFO, we had to buy Instagram because Facebook users were leaving Facebook for Instagram, and by buying Instagram, Zuck would make sure that if you left Facebook the company, you would still be captured by Facebook the platform. And despite the fact that Mark Zuckerberg put this competition in writing, you know, Bob, the murder we are planning, just to be sure, it is a murder and we are premeditating it. The Obama administration let the merger go ahead because every government of every political stripe for 40 years adopted the posture that monopolies were efficient. Now think back to those twiddled, immiserated nurses. Hospitals are among the most consolidated sectors in America. And the way that that happened is first we deregulated pharma mergers, and the pharma companies gobbled each other up at the rate of knots, and then they jacked up the price of drugs. So hospitals merged to regional monopolies too in a defensive maneuver that let a single hospital chain corner a region or a city and say to the pharma companies, either you make your products cheaper or none of the hospitals in the city will get your products. Of course, once this mission was accomplished, the hospitals turned around and screwed the insurers, who staged their own incestuous orgy, buying and merging until most of us in America have just two or three insurance options, which let the insurers fight it back against the hospitals. But it left the patients and the healthcare workers defenseless against the consolidated power of hospitals, pharma companies, pharmacy benefit managers, group purchasing organizations, and other health industry cartels, monopolies, and duopolies. Which is why nurses end up signing on to work for hospitals that use these ghastly apps. Meanwhile, on the patient side, competition has never particularly disciplined healthcare. No one has ever shopped around for a cheaper ambulance on their way to the ER while they were having a heart attack. And the price that people are paying not to die is everything. So you have this sector that shouldn't even be a commercial sector in the first place, losing the tiny amount of discipline they once faced from competition, paving the way for enshittification. But like I said, there are four forces that prevent enshittification in tech, not just competition, not just regulation, not just competition, but also regulation. It's a mistake to see market discipline, competition, and state discipline, regulation, as separate realms. They are intimately connected because competition is a necessary condition for effective regulation. Even if you are the kind of Musk-addled libertarian whose copy of Atlas Shrugged no longer opens because the pages are stuck together, who pines for a market in human kidneys and demands the right to sell yourself into slavery if you should so choose, you should still want robust antitrust, because otherwise, how will the contracts be enforced? The referee has to be more powerful than the players in the game. when a sector cartelizes, when it collapses into oligarchy, when the internet becomes five giant websites filled with screenshots of the other four, it captures its regulators. Because a sector with 100 companies, it's a rabble. It's at each other's throat. They can't agree on anything, much less how they're going to lobby their lawmakers or their enforcers. But a sector of five companies, or four, or three, or two, or one, that's a cartel. It's a racket. It's a conspiracy in waiting. A sector that has been boiled down to a mere handful of firms can agree on a common lobbying position. And what's more, because they've divided up the world like the Pope divided up the market like the Pope dividing up the New World, they can insulate themselves from wasteful competition, which leaves them aslosh in cash that they can mobilize to make their regulatory preferences into regulation. In other words, they can capture their regulators. So regulatory capture is a phrase that is very abstract, but I'll give you a concrete example. In the United Kingdom, there is an extraordinarily effective regulator for competition, the Competition and Markets Authority, and until January, it was run by a guy called Marcus Bokerink. It was one of the most effective regulators and investigators of tech monopolies in the world until January, when Keir Starmer fired the head of the Competition and Markets Authority and replaced him with the former head of Amazon UK. So back to nurses. There are plenty of examples of regulatory capture in the story of the nurses, but I'm going to pick the most egregious one. And that is the fact that you can just go to a data broker and buy the financial history of pretty much everyone in America. And this is because the US Congress has not passed a new consumer privacy law since 1988, when Ronald Reagan signed the Video Privacy Protection Act, which bans video store clerks from telling newspapers which VHS cassettes you have. The fact that Congress has not addressed a single new technological privacy threat since Die Hard was in its first run in theaters is not a coincidence and it's not an oversight. It is expensively purchased inaction from a heavily concentrated, wildly profitable privacy invasion industry that has monetized the abuse of human rights at unimaginable scale. The coalition in favor of keeping privacy law frozen keeps growing because there is an unbounded set of ways to transmute the systematic invasion of our privacy into cash. There is a direct line from this phenomenon to nurses whose paychecks go down when they can't pay their credit card bills. So competition is dead, regulation is dead, and companies are no longer disciplined by markets nor by states. But there are four forces that discipline tech firms, contributing to an inhospitable environment for the reproduction of sociopathic and shitifying monsters within the firm. So let's talk about those other two factors. The first is interoperability, the principle of two or more things working together. And in the non-digital world, it's a lot of work. To make the light socket that can take any light bulb, you have to agree on the thread, its direction, its pitch, its diameter. You have to agree on the voltage, the amperage, the wattage of the socket, or the next time someone changes the light bulb, they're going to blow their hand off. But in the digital world, we kind of get interop built in, because once again, the only computer we really know how to make is that Turing complete universal von Neumann machine, the computer capable of executing every valid program, which means that for every enshittifying code, there is disenshittifying code waiting to be written. Every 10-foot wall invites the 11-foot code ladder. When HP writes a program to ensure that its printers reject third-party ink, someone else could write a program that allows your printer to take anyone's ink. Now, here in the US, there's a company called Para that shipped an app to help DoorDash drivers maximize their revenue driving for DoorDash. You see, DoorDash drivers make most of their money from tips, and the DoorDash driver app was hiding the tip amount from the driver until they irrevocably committed to taking the ride, which meant that you didn't know if you were taking a job that would pay you $1.50 or $11.50 with a $10 tip until you agreed to take it. So Para, they made an app that would unwrap the JSON object, find out what the tip was, and display it at the same time as the driver getting it. But then DoorDash shut it down. Because in America, apps like Para, they're illegal. Because in 1998, Bill Clinton signed a law called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And Section 1201 of the DMCA makes it a felony to bypass an access control for a copyrighted work with a maximum penalty of a $500,000 fine and a 5-year prison sentence for a first offense. So just the act of reverse engineering an app like the DoorDash app is a potential felony, which is why companies are so desperately horny to get you to use apps instead of websites. The web is open, apps are closed. The majority of web users have installed an ad blocker, which is also a privacy blocker, but no one has ever installed an ad blocker for their apps because it's a felony to make and distribute that tool because you have to reverse engineer the app's DRM to make it. An app is just a website that we have wrapped in the correct DRM to make it a felony to protect your privacy while you use it. All around the world, thank you. All around the world, we have enacted a thicket of laws. We call them IP laws that make it illegal to modify products and services so they serve our interests rather than the interests of the firms that ship them. And like I said, these laws were enacted by in living memory by people who walk among us who were warned of the obvious, eminently foreseeable consequences of doing this, and they are still there anyway. Europe adopted a version of this in 2001 at the insistence of the U.S. Trade Representative. It's Article 6 of the Copyright Directive, and it copy-pastes DMCA 1201 into Europe's law books. Canada did the same thing in 2012 with a bill called C-11. Experts warned their leaders that laws that ban tampering with digital locks would let American tech giants corner digital markets in their countries, forcing them to buy their apps and games from American app stores that could cream off any commission that they wanted to levy. They warned that these laws were a gift to monopolists that wanted to jack up the price of ink. For example, HP, which is the leader in a very small field of inkjet companies, which has raised the price of ink over and over again until ink has become the most expensive substance you as a civilian can buy without a permit. It runs more than $10,000 a gallon. You print out your shopping list with colored water that costs more than the semen of a Kentucky Derby winning stallion. So these copyright laws, they didn't serve artists. They locked them to American platforms because every time someone in another country, bought your work, a book, a song, a game, a video, it came locked in an American app that could never be unlocked. So if creative workers in another country tried to migrate to a domestic store, the audience couldn't come with them because they couldn't move their purchases out of that US app and into a local one. And politicians ignored these warnings. And now all over the world, it is illegal to tamper with a digital lock. So when a company puts a digital lock on a product, they can do anything behind that lock, and it's a crime to undo that. This is the world that the U.S. Trade Representative demanded, a world where farmers can't fix their tractors and independent mechanics can't fix your car, where hospitals during the pandemic lockdowns could not fix their failing ventilators, where every time a foreign iPhone user buys an app from a local software author, the dollar they spend makes a round trip through Cupertino, California, and comes back 30 cents lighter. Interoperability was once a major disciplining force on tech firms. After all, if you make the ads on your website sufficiently obnoxious, some fraction of your users will be inspired to install an ad blocker, which means that you never get another penny from them, because while many users have installed ad blockers, no user has ever voluntarily uninstalled an ad blocker. But once it's illegal to make the ad blocker, there's no reason not to make the ads as disgusting, invasive, and obnoxious as you can, and shift all the value from users to shareholders and executives. So we get monopolies. Monopolies capture regulators. They ignore the laws they don't like. They prevent laws that might interfere with predatory conduct, like privacy laws, from being passed. They get new laws passed that let them wield government power to prevent other companies from entering the market. So three of our four forces have been neutralized: competition, regulation, and interop. But that leaves one disciplining force that did hold enchidification at bay for quite some time, and that is labor. Because we tech workers, we are a strange kind of workforce. We have historically been very powerful, able to command very high wages and respect, but we did it without joining unions. Union density in tech is abysmal. It is almost undetectable. Tech workers' power never came from solidarity, it came from scarcity. There just weren't enough tech workers to fill the jobs that were going begging. And tech workers pulled out all the stops to motivate us to work on the projects that we believed in for endless hours. But the minute bosses ordered us to enshittify the products that we'd missed our mother's funerals to ship on time, we told our bosses to fuck off. And if the bosses persisted in those demands, we could walk across the street to another firm and have a new job by the end of the day. So for many years, tech workers were the fourth and final constraint that held the line after the constraints of competition, regulation, and interop were systematically stripped away. But then came the mass tech layoffs, 500,000 since 2023, and you've probably heard Meta is doing a 5% headcount reduction, something they announced the same day that they announced they were doubling their executive bonuses. This is not a firm that is afraid of its workers anymore. Tech workers do not tell their bosses to go fuck themselves because there are 10 other workers waiting to take their jobs. If you've ever wondered why tech bosses are so horny for the idea of AI coders, it's because it makes them think that they'll be able to fire coders and replace them with client chatbots who'll never tell them to fuck off. So that's where enshittification comes from. Multiple changes to our environment, the fourfold collapse of competition, regulation, and worker power, and interop. This created the enshittogenic environment where the greediest, most sociopathic elements in the body corporate thrived at the expense of those elements that acted as moderators against their enshittificatory impulses. And until we fix that environment, the contagion will continue to spread to other firms. So how do we create a hostile environment for enshittifiers? We're not going to get rid of the elements in the firm that are greedy or don't care about users. So long as the profit motive is intact, there will be people whose pursuit of profit is pathological, unmoderated by any sense of shame or decency. But we can change the environment so they don't dominate firms and they don't dominate our lives. So we'll talk about antitrust. After 40 years of antitrust decline, this decade has seen a massive global resurgence of antitrust vigor. And it's bipartisan. I mean, sure, UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer did just fire the head of the Competition and Markets Authority and replace him with the former head of Amazon UK. But the thing that makes this so tragic and noteworthy is that the CMA was an incredible agency doing some of the most important competition work the tech world has ever seen under a succession of conservative governments. And in the EU, they've passed the Digital Markets Act and the Digital Services Act, going after big tech with both barrels. And other countries around the world, Australia, Germany, France, Japan, South Korea, and China, yes, China, have passed new antitrust laws, launched major antitrust enforcements, and they often collaborate with one another. So when the UK Competition and Markets Authority used its investigatory powers to research and publish a deep market study on Apple's abuse of 30% app tax, the EU used that as a roadmap to fine Apple for billions of euros and ban Apple payment monopolies under new regulations. And then that case was translated into Korean and Japanese and run again through their courtrooms with nearly identical cases that also won. So antitrust is doing some important work right now, and it's doing it without billionaire funding, right? This is a genuinely grassroots phenomenon. There are no billionaires funding the project to make billionaires obsolete. So what about regulatory capture? Well, we're seeing regulators getting smarter about reining in big tech. The EU's new tech regulations, they bypass the Irish courts, which are friendly territory for the tech companies that pretend that they're Irish, and they're now moving these to national courts, so new privacy claims under the GDPR are going to start in the federal courts in Europe. Europe and Canada have passed muscular right to repair legislation, but those right to repair laws have been hamstrung by the anti-circumvention laws, the laws like the DMCA that make it illegal to bypass a lock, which means that you can only use your anti-repair law if you don't have to bypass a lock in order to make the repair. And there are locks that prevent repairs in every car, every tractor, every appliance, every medical implant, every hospital medical device. Which means that these big tech disciplining laws on repair and interoperability, they're hamstrung. Which raises this question, why don't these countries just repeal their anti-circumvention laws? Why don't they ban the laws that, or why don't they get rid of the laws that ban tampering with DRM? Well, the answer is that the U.S. Trade Representative for 25 years has said that having a law like this on your books is a condition of getting access to American markets without paying tariffs. Happy Liberation Day, everyone. All over the world, we've seen this reflexive response to impose retaliatory tariffs, which just makes everything that the people in your country buy from America more expensive. It's a very weird way to punish Americans. It's like punching yourself in the face really hard and hoping someone else says, ouch. You know what would be better? Just abolishing these laws that allow big tech companies to operate without foreign competitors that disenshittify the products that they collect rents with. Make it legal to reverse engineer, jailbreak, and modify American products and services. Make it legal for every mechanic, thank you, make it legal for every mechanic to jailbreak every Tesla and unlock all the subscription features and software upgrades for one price forever, so that Tesla owners get more out of their cars. Those features go along with them when they sell those cars, so they're worth more as used vehicles. That is how you hurt Elon Musk. Not by being performatively offended at the Nazi salute. That guy loves the attention. You do it by kicking him really hard in the dongle. Let Canadians stand up a Canadian app store for games consoles and mobile devices that charges 3% to process transactions, not 30%, so every Canadian news outlet that sells subscriptions through an app and every Canadian software author, musician, and writer who sells through a mobile platform or games console will get a 25% increase in revenue overnight without signing up a single new customer. But of course, they will sign up new customers because selling jailbreaking software and access to app stores from everywhere in the world for every mobile console, every games console, pitching every games publisher, every app maker to selling in foreign app stores without paying the 30% VIG to Apple, to American big tech companies, that offering every mechanic in the world a $100 a month kit that can diagnose every car instead of the $10,000 per manufacturer per year official diagnostic tools, allowing every farmer in the world to buy a kit that lets them fix their own John Deere tractors instead of doing the repair but then still having to pay John Deere $200 to come out, look at your tractor, and type an unlock code into the console, they will beat a path to that country's door. Any country in the world has it right now in their power to become a tech export powerhouse, making everything cheaper for tech users all over the world while making everything more profitable for anyone who sells media or software in online stores. And it will be a frontal assault on the largest, most profitable U.S. companies, the companies that single-handedly kept the S&P 500 in the black, and it attacks their most profitable lines of business. It takes the revenues from those rip-off scams globally from hundreds of billions of dollars to zero overnight. That is how you win trade wars. We are entering a period, thank you, we are entering a period of omni-shambolic polycrisis. The ominous rumble of climate change, authoritarianism, genocide, transphobia, and xenophobia has turned into an avalanche. The perpetrators of these crimes against humanity weaponized the internet. They colonized the 21st century's digital nervous system and used it to attack the host, threatening civilization itself. The Inshitternet was purpose-built for this kind of apocalyptic co-option, organized around giant corporations who will trade a habitable planet and human rights for a 3% tax cut, who default us all into twiddle-friendly algorithmic feeds and block the interoperability that would let us escape their clutches with the backing of powerful governments whom they can call upon to protect their IP rights. It didn't have to be this way. The Inshitternet was not inevitable. It was the product of specific policy choices made in living memory by named individuals. They chose Inshittification. We warned them what would come of it, and we don't have to be eternal prisons of the catastrophic policy blunders of clueless lawmakers of old. As the omni-shambolic polycrisis unfolds around us, countries around the world have means, motive, and opportunity to craft policies to bolster their privacy, protect their people's rights, and help set every technology user in every country, including America, because how the hell will you stop Americans from buying software tools when we have a global internet to set us all free? The Trump presidency is an existential crisis, but it also presents an opportunity. When life gives you SARS, you make sarsaparilla. We once had an old, good internet whose major defect was that it required too much technical expertise to use, so our normie friends couldn't join us in this amazing party we were having. Web 2.0's online services created grease slides that made it easy for anyone to get online, but escaping the walled gardens they had meant that you had to climb a greased pole. A new good internet is possible and it is necessary, and we can build it with all this technological self-determination of the old good internet and the ease of Web 2.0. A place where we can find each other, coordinate, and mobilize to resist and survive climate collapse, fascism, genocide, and authoritarianism. We can build that new good internet, and we must. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Corey. What a fantastic talk.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.